This is a podcast about the Bibliotheque album, forthcoming album from Moments, the 2012 album, and it's based on some song-by-song notes I made about the record for Chavalada, which is a Spanish webzine. A couple of things just off the top of my head that strike me about the record is that I'm singing quite low and softly on it, and using what John Shuttleworth would call microphone technique. When I sing live, the songs that work well are ones where I hit high registers and kind of belt out the notes, but on record, partly because of the limitations of my rather cheap mic, I tend to sing very low, and the result is this kind of flat, compressed sound. The vocal just a kind of thin ionosphere floating above the music. And that seems to work well, and it also goes well with the kind of literary nature of my material. That said, I don't think this is a particularly word-oriented record. There are large chunks of music which are instrumental, and it does come in terms of some of the samples I used and in terms of some of the experiences I'd had. It comes very much from the last project I did, which may not see the light of day. I'm not entirely sure what's happening with it. It's an instrumental record called Momus in Samoa, which was commissioned by a local entrepreneur here in Osaka, club runner and journalist, music journalist called Agi Uzuru, who asked me to make some sort of concept record about Robert Louis Stevenson's last years in Samoa. And I went back to the violin, which I'd learned at school but really hated. My violin teacher, Mr. Stewart, was essentially only at home on the touchline of a rugby match. And it put me off very much because I was trying to write my own music, notate my own music at that point. And he snatched away a manuscript page and plonked it on the piano and started thumping it out in a really sarcastic way, as if to say, "You're complete rubbish. You think you can jump ahead to a slide rule when you haven't mastered the ruler yet." So, and perhaps he was right, but it wasn't a very nice way to encourage a boy. So last summer, anyway, July and August mostly, I was working on Samoa, the Samoa project, and sawing, scraping away at the violin. One of the results is the final track on Bibliotheque, which is my cover of Green Isaac 2 by Prefab Sprout. And the other is, well, some of the chords for Southbound came out of those sessions, and also the song Lycidas. It was a kind of guilty pleasure during the instrumental recording. So I'm going to run through with little sound clips to illustrate the songs, as if you hadn't heard them by now in the YouTube playlist. The record is coming out, in theory, on the 1st of June, and I think of that as the hard copy, because it's already floating in a Hermes-like way. It's floating around the earth in the form of a YouTube playlist. And now, in my mind, a YouTube playlist is an album. And it's a full circle. Again, like the Hypnoprism album, I really established this working process on Hypnoprism, the 2010 album from Momus. The Bibliotheque is the same thing as the Hypnoprism, because Hypnoprism, as I explained at the time, was my word for YouTube, which is a haunted archive, an electronic library. So Bibliotheque, there aren't many books in Bibliotheque, although you'll hear some literary references in these little précis. It's actually a library, because Bibliotheque is the Swedish word for library, it's a library of electronic signals. And it's a haunted library, a haunted archive. So we'll get back to that theme later, but let's go through the songs one by one now. Starting with Arrays, which establishes the overall genre of the album, which I think of as pastoral horror.
He raised the sky, the sun, undoing everyone. He raised the house, he raised the tree, he raised my memory. Make this useless process end, and so begin again.
You can think of films like Blood on Satan's Claw or The Wicker Man. British horror films made by Hammer and British Lion and other companies, which were in the early 70s mixing the bucolic, which is the pastoral, the rural, with the horrific, and sometimes with the erotic as well. So they often involved rites of spring, May festivals, strange rituals out in the forest, druidical goings on. And of course, Bibliotheque was recorded in spring, and I tried to make a point of recording my albums in spring because I have a superstitious belief that the raw energy of the revitalizing year, the nature awakening from its hibernation, will infuse my record. And to some extent, I think it does. But also, April is the cruelest month, as T.S. Eliot said. It is a time when your sublimation terminates, and you wake. So in sometimes uncomfortable ways, your sexuality reawakens, your loins begin to throb, and you don't necessarily have an outlet, or you have problems with your partner, or you don't have a partner. So I don't shy away from those problems of spring. The cruelty of spring, the kind of cryogenic freezing turning into a thaw. So there's an element of that as well going on, that the thaw is a painful one, almost a kind of Frankenstein uttering a great moan of pain because he's waking. The album starts with a race. It wasn't the first track I recorded. The first track in the spring 2012 sessions was Southbound, but Erase just seemed the perfect way to begin because it establishes the pastoral horror theme, but it also has this echoed line, "and so begin again," which is almost a Beckett line, I think, you know, and a kind of weary sigh, "and so we begin again, it's happening again." The old lyrical sap is rising, and we sense pain on the way as a result, but also pleasure. So YouTube is the Bibliotheque, the haunted archive. We're haunted by electronic ghosts, and they live in an electronic library. They make life easy for us because they bring us the voices of the dead, but they also make things hard for us because the voices of the dead sound so much more alive than our own voices. And this is what I've called retro-necro. It's the current tragedy of pop music, overwhelmed by its past, by the weight of its past, and by the dead. The voices of the dead, which of course harks back to Edison. You hear the voice of an Edison demonstrator, at least, at the end of my song, "The Artist Overwhelmed." And in a sense, we're all, pop musicians are all now artists overwhelmed. Edison says, or his assistant says, "You can hear the voices of your loved ones as if they were near, although they're far away." There is something spooky about that voice, and also about the whole idea of hearing the voices of your loved ones, especially the voices of dead loved ones, because this is what phonographic recording enabled us to do for the first time, and it's really a communion with ghosts and with demons. And it's now reached this different stage when we're all haunted by the archives, which are so overwhelming, and we've forgotten how to erase the archive. So the song Erase makes a very radical proposal. It says, let's erase everything. Erase the sky, erase the trees, and so begin again. Because in a sense, that's the only way to start again, fresh, without the burden of tradition. But of course, it's a utopian and a year zero, in a sense. Utopia and dystopia on this record are just a hair's breadth from each other, as kind of Pol Pot understanding of the attraction, but also the horror of erasure and of starting again. So we're in the archival horror film. And this connects Erase and some of the other songs on Bibliotheque to the Ghostbox label, which resurrects library music. And of course, Bibliotheque is a library. A library music which was made for films and television in the 70s. I had a lot of these records, made often with synths, in the 90s when we were all listening to Stereolab and Broadcast and going out and buying rather expensive vinyl copies of old 70s library music. And so a lot of the songs on Bibliotheque have a filmic quality, film soundtrack-like quality, or actually accompany films, or actually, going back to the YouTube full circle idea, they come out of the very songs that they use for their own videos, because the song and the video were created in exactly the same session, in a long, very concentrated session, and are really different facets of the same process. So I think of it not really as even just songwriting anymore. It's more to do with a kind of a wrangling of data. It's data wrangling. It's me going and being inspired by this haunted library which is out there, which seems to make every sort of music accessible simultaneously, and fusing it, throwing it all together in new combinations which attempt to jumpstart the creative process, but which end neatly labelled in the Dewey Decimal System, no doubt, back on the shelves of the library pretty much immediately. So we'll see that process over and over again in these songs. But the only way out of the tragedy of the haunted library and the weight of the haunted library and the haunting, you know, apart from an exorcism, the only way out is to erase everything and so begin again. And yet, for an archivist or for an archive, nothing is more horrific and more unthinkable than erasure. So Lycidas, which was one of the first songs written before the album was conceived, really, happened last summer when I was working on Samoa. And I think the song came to me in a dream. I often get songs that way, and they're fully formed. They arrive with the melodies and the chords and the lyrics, most of the lyrics anyway. It just takes a little bit of elaboration when I wake up to sing them into a microphone, write them down somewhere. They're fully formed, and it's quite incredible. They're often very catchy songs as well, songs that have come straight out of your subconscious and are therefore very suited to going back into your subconscious in the form of earworms, very hit-like songs, pop hit songs. I think this happened in an episode of The Partridge Family once, and it turned out that David Cassidy had actually simply dreamed a song that existed and was already a hit and had plagiarized. So you never quite know if you're not plagiarizing someone else's song. But as far as I know, there is no other song like Lycidas. What I like about this song is that it's accidentally quite profound. I think the lyrics seem to be nonsensical. All this stuff about you'll be who I want in the end and that'll be you, it seems almost tautological. But actually it's about trying to influence somebody and trying to change somebody. And it does beg some quite profound questions about identity, because we are all influenced and changed by everything from advertising to our partners, to our parents, to school, to the socialization process. And which is us? Is it the before or after? It throws identity into the machinery of time itself, throws away the idea of fixed, continuous identity. And that's a spooky idea. In a way, that says that we might be, if not ghosts, at least palimpsests, ciphers. Something else I want to say about this song is that it's got a very funky toasting DJ in the middle. I sampled a Jamaican DJ toasting and dropped the sample into the pitch of the song and then flipped it up an octave with a thing called a vocal transformer in GarageBand. And put a filter on it, and lo and behold, it turned into almost exactly the same sound as a scraping violin sample I had in there, me playing the violin. And now they're so seamless that you would think that the violin starts to toast, starts to do a Jamaican accent and actually rap in the middle of the song. So that's a haunted violin if ever I heard one.
Dead, but still high-functioning specter of the night, and I am shuddering, and she steps into the light.
Dunes, the third track, started with Toru Takemitsu's score for the 1964 Japanese film The Woman in the Dunes. That's the English title. It's actually the literal translation of the Japanese title is Sand Woman. And it's based on a novel by Kobo Abe. And it's got this melting, fantastic kind of horror film, but not quite horror film, because it's also quite a sensual sound. It's the sound of everything melting in the dunes and the sun, really. The strings just melt. The notes don't hold. It all slips, just as sand slips down into a pit in the dunes. And, of course, the film is set in a pit, which an entomologist can't escape from. And he becomes trapped, like one of his own insect samples, by a woman who's lying there naked, trying to make him make love to her. But he at first resists, but then goes along with it. My story is a little bit different. It's about a succubus. The ghost of a girl who's committed suicide comes back to seduce her lover in the form of a succubus, and he complies with mixed emotions. He says, "I am shuddering," as she steps into the light. It's really set in the area where the erotic meets the horrific, and that's a very interesting area for me. One of my favorite quotes is from the poet Rilke, the German poet: "Beauty is nothing but the beginning of terror that we're still able to bear." He says that in the Duino Elegies. I think it's significant that I've been in the middle of writing a horror film script set in the BBC in the 1950s, a kind of radiophonic workshop setting, which is also a horror and ghost setting, a haunted radiophonic workshop. And that idea of the experimental plus the horrific plus the sensual, it's a love story as well, has definitely fed into the Bibliotheque album. She still seems strangely distant, though you're lying there so close, tangled in the satin sheets, taking off her clothes. There's a disco in the distance, and the drugs are kicking in, and you feel a bit self-conscious, cause your body looks so thin. You notice that quite suddenly, through unexpected tears, that her eyes are metropolitan, like Amanda Lear's. And listening to the record by Valerie Doray, you drift away. The fourth song is Farther. And it's really my take on the New Romantics, take on David Bowie's 1980 take on his alienated astronaut, Major Tom. The New Romantics, there was a spate of hits by bands like Landscape and sort of new wave synth bands replicating Ashes to Ashes. And there was a sense of alienation and anxiety because of the Cold War, because of missiles, because of people's fear of nuclear annihilation. Hello, planet Earth, I'm far away from what you're feeling, what you're experiencing, all these weapons you're buying. It just seemed that the world bristled with weapons at that point. And Bowie wasn't just singing about Major Tom deliberately staying away from the Earth and feeding himself with space junk, space heroin. He was also singing if they should shoot some of those missiles and treat us as fatherless scum, it won't be forgotten. It really seemed for a while, with the Afghanistan war at that time and the Cold War continuing, it seemed a dangerous time. So I'm juxtaposing that sort of emotion, which for me is mixed with the idea of living in Japan, because when you're in Japan you feel farther away from everything. And also the age that I'm advancing into, which is middle age, I think you'd have to call it, even possibly old age, in which you start to feel a bit further away from the dialogues and the concerns, the trivial, especially the capitalistic and commercial concerns that people have and that you had when you were more ambitious, perhaps, and younger. You were more identified with capitalism, and I certainly find that I'm a bit less identified with that. I've juxtaposed that emotion with a midsection, or a verse section rather, two verses which are kind of European disco dilettantes zonked out on drugs, making love in a 1970s apartment. And it makes me think of Al Stewart or the band Metro, a certain sort of breezy sensuality, gauzy net curtains filmed in slow motion, And I chose Peter Godwin from Metro. Metro, who of course also wrote Criminal World, which David Bowie covered on Let's Dance, to feature in my video, alongside Valerie Duray and Alberto Camerini. So there's a sense of slightly ridiculous new romantic sexuality, sensuality, mixed with, you know, the final countdown nuclear anxieties of the 80s. The next song is Core.
With you on my brain, on the ghost train, dancing the waltz with the corpses. Everything's horrid in hell, dear. Wishing to hell, wishing to hell, wishing to hell you were here.
And this started because I was listening on YouTube on the Bibliotheque to a really terrible song by Lou Reed, which is called Guilty. I think it's from his album The Raven. A link popped up on the right-hand side to another song, also called Guilty, which was sung by Al Boley, and it's from the early 30s, and that was much, much better. And I possibly had vague memories of hearing it in the film Amelie. But anyway, I set to work sampling the chords to that and then made my own lyrics to it, a bit like the Charm song or some of the tracks on the Thunderclown album, my 2011 album with John Hendrickson. And my lyrics are about a man who's in hell. The original lyrics just say, I'm guilty, guilty. If this is wrong, you know, I don't want to be right kind of lyrics. Guilty of loving you. In my song, a man has been left by his girlfriend, and he's in hell as a result, and he sends her a postcard from hell saying, wish you were here. Pack me a trunk, book me a bunk, and why don't you come and join me in hell? So, mixed emotions there. He wants to be with her, but he wants to be with her in a hellish place. Then in the middle, there's this text, which in the video, it seems to be part of Peter Greenaway's brilliant TV Dante, his version of Dante's Inferno, and it looks as if the actors in that, including, I think, Sir John Gielgud, are mouthing it. But in fact, it's a précis of a Franz Schubert song, Wasserflut, Water Flood. He weeps copiously and his tears fall in the snow. When the spring comes, the snow will melt and flow into a river, carrying his tears to the house of his beloved, the source of all his misery. And the ambivalence of spring is a big part of this record. April is the cruelest month and all that. Spring creates and the spring destroys. Southbound was the first song written specifically for Bibliotheque, and it was started really just at the end of March. The album happened very fast. Albums used to be recorded this way. In the 60s and 70s, you'd record a side a day or something. And I like working fast. I think things, when they work immediately, and there's no need to redo them, question them, rejig them. They just fall into place, and there's a deep satisfaction I get from doing everything in one session, including the video. It's not just because it's cheap, and it's not just because I have other things to do. But Southbound was the first song, and in English, when you say things have gone south, it means they've gone to hell, to rack and ruin, and it's an expression which dates from the American Civil War, casting aspersions on the South, that if things go south, they will all go wrong. They can't do anything down there. So my character's driving through the night, possibly weeping as he drives. He's fleeing a relationship in which he's been only there in theory and absent without leaving, which is a phrase I stole from Howard Devoto. Sorry, Howard. Such a good phrase, though. The pastoral theme returns, if only as an idea, because my narrator, my driver, is going to the apple grove. The apple grove is where he'll rove, and so it's a roving song, a modern blues, a folk song, set to chords which are electronic and Eno-esque, and to a kind of filtered percussion which builds the urgency through the song. And there's also a ghost in the lyrics, because before it was Southbound, it was a different song called Bad Dad. So you can hear the old vocal peeking through in the mix, singing the Bad Dad lyrics, and as it were haunting the new song.
Once there was a man, and only one thing made him happy. Her eyes and her lips were so huge. And when she was gone, everything made him happy. The world was so huge and so new.
The next song is huge, and a very beautiful Chilean-born New York artist called Gia Files asked me if she could make one of the videos for Bibliotheque. And at first I told her, well, you know, I'm so impatient to make my own videos and to share these songs with the world as soon as they're made that I doubt that I'd have the patience to send you something and wait a few days or even a few weeks for you to do a video. And I knew that also she was very busy at that time. She was on deadline for her own illustration work. But I told her that if she sent me videos of herself, knowing that she would look great in them, I'd write a new song around the videos, specifically, a bit like a Stars Forever song. And that's really how it ended up, although I kept sending emails while I was writing the song saying, Gia, quick, send me something. You know, I'm writing the song already. I don't want, you know, I wanted there to be some interaction between the visuals and the song. I wanted Gia to hear the song or me to see the visuals. As it turned out, they were done at pretty much the same time. I think our mails crossed each other. I sent her a mail with an MP3 of the finished song, and she sent me a link to the raw video footage of herself, which was her making up and doing her hair, mixed in with these amazing shots of a software version of herself, naked and clothed, a kind of Gia doll. And my song is a love song of rejection. A bit like I Want You But I Don't Need You, because it's rejecting the monomania, the obsession, the passion of saying, you mean the world to me. That expression, you mean the world to me. And my narrator says tenderly that the girl cannot mean the world to him, because then what would the world itself mean? She can't mean everything in the world to him, because the world has to be bigger than any one person. And in Leonard Cohen's Book of Longing, there's a beautiful line, only one thing made him happy, and now that it was gone, everything made him happy. The one thing that made you happy. And we all know what is the one thing that makes men happy. In the video, just to underline it, there's a little upskirt shot. As that begins to ebb and recede and make you less happy, everything else, other things come in to replace it, surprisingly enough. Other sources and centers and passions can replace it. So other things make you happy, and sex becomes less important. And a bit like the men in The Girl from Ipanema, you just, when a beauty passes, you just go, ah.
They say a black magician trained a blackjack doll to talk. The ghost of Colin Wilson has an electronic jaw.
Jackdaw was actually the last song completed for the album, and it's really about that moment in British culture, the pastoral horror moment of the early 70s. And at about the same time, I was a schoolboy. Schoolboys like me were reading Alan Garner novels like The Owl Service or Clive King's Stick of the Dump. There's references to those spooky tales peppering the song. But there's also an allusion to David Bowie's early song from his chirpy 1960s cabaret period, which often, if you listen a bit more closely, they're quite creepy songs about weird things happening to children, children trying to live in a separate world, children, Tibetans and funny old eccentric uncles. That's the topics of... I really like his early cabaret songs. I think they're the closest possibly in what he's done to MoMA's songs, those and the Brecht EP, the Baal EP that he made, which is hugely influential on, for example, my vocal technique, if you listen to The Drowned Girl, for instance. But there's a song called There Is a Happy Land, which actually mentions rhubarb patches and things, a bit like Jackdaw does. But when I sing this song, I think of my grandparents' garden in Blainfield, which is on in the Campsie Mountains. And a long garden which goes up the hill and joins into the mountains eventually, and which had a rhubarb patch. And beyond the rhubarb patch, some sort of frightening things, like a little forest and an old run-down summer house with a wind-up gramophone in it and some old 78s. And I found all that a little spooky, and I suppose I was haunted already by someone else's archive, an archive of heavy lacquer discs that spun at 78 and on a wind-up machine, a machine you didn't even plug in. I think at the same time, my grandfather, David Hood, that's my mother's father, bought me the first David Bowie album I owned, which was the Ziggy Stardust album. So there was this other archive which I was just beginning to build up myself and to be haunted by in turn.
Like a black diamond.
Erostratus revisits a song I wrote in 2002, just after 9/11 happened. And I was, of course, in New York when 9/11 happened, and I was watching it from my roof, and I saw the towers collapsing, and I saw the second plane coming in. I ran away to Tokyo because the atmosphere in New York changed so suddenly. And when I was writing the Oscar Tennis Champion album in 2002 in Tokyo, I read about a Jean-Paul Sartre short story which mentions Erostratus, this character who burned down one of the seven wonders of the world at that time, the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus, and whose name lived on, according to Sartre, like a black diamond. And it seemed immediately clear to me that Erostratus was a previous incarnation of Osama bin Laden, perhaps a relative of the stammering character Mizoguchi, an ugly arsonist, hero of Mishima's Temple of the Golden Pavilion. And Mizoguchi's ugliness makes him obsessed with beauty and with destroying it. And I think he would have understood not just the Erostratus song, but also the Erase song. Because there is a Hindu god, Shiva, who incarnates creation and destruction. And that's something I think we haven't really understood with our acquisitive need to preserve everything. The archive is really a kind of materialism extended to ideas, that we must never destroy anything. Everything must be available. Everything must be stocked in there. And we don't realize that actually encumbers and lumbers us. So I've felt recently that I kind of wish there was a sort of warehouse fire, a half wish. There's a warehouse fire in Berlin where all my boxes are currently in storage, so that I could start again. And I would feel so much younger and fresher, just walk away from my material goods. And I kind of extend the same thinking to the archive and to culture. It's almost as if, wouldn't it be great to start everything again, to delete our cities and go back to a kind of nomadic shepherding existence? I mean, the shepherds in the video for the Erase song are a kind of leitmotif, and that is the bucolic tradition, isn't it, that we all think of ourselves as shepherds. Lycidas, the original Milton poem of that name, which I had to memorize for pocket money when I was a teenager. It's a poem Milton wrote about the death by drowning of a friend of his, but he describes his friend as a shepherd. And of course, neither Milton nor his friend were actually shepherds, but that was the pastoral mode of the time. That to be a good chap, you had to be a shepherd. You had to have your own flock of sheep and be playing a flute and not be really too involved in the rest of life and the world.
You'll have to see this order fall. The old world dies in sheets of flame, its banks destroyed.
In International is probably influenced by the Occupy movement. It's a song using Paul Dessau's music from Mother Courage, from the Brecht play of the same name. My song expresses a genuine desire for a resurgence of communism at a time when inequality has never been greater. The Occupy movement defined and influenced that idea because it's been telling us that the world is illegally squatted by a 1% whose interests are very different from those of the rest of us. So that 1% is something else to erase. Put that on the erase list. And for the video, I used choreography from the propaganda opera The East is Red, a Chinese film from 1964, which has some wonderful Maoist kitsch in it, including dainty People's Army cadres dancing with machine guns.
But I am shunned. You turn from me. And I'm imprisoned. But you're not free.
So after all the erasures that he's been implementing, the singer finds himself erased socially. He's criticized a bit too much. He's been sent to Coventry, perhaps for rebuilding, reprogramming, or perhaps just as a punishment. He's imprisoned, banned, and shunned, which is standard Puritan punishment. It's still practiced today by sects like the Amish. But I think it happens on a much wider scale as well, because if your messages don't fit with the prevailing ideology, you really are neglected, ignored, and shunned yourself, and the gatekeepers try their best to shut you up. And Tocqueville, Alexis de Tocqueville, visiting America from France in the 18th century, noted that pluralistic democratic freedom was just a more subtle expression of ancien regime coercion. He said, the master no longer says in America, you shall think as I do or you shall die. He says, you're free to think differently from me, to retain your life, your property, and all that you possess, but you are henceforth a stranger among your people. And that's what the character singing Shunned feels. He's wandering in the video through a weirdly ornate subway station in Stockholm, which has been turned into a sort of underground art museum. And there's nobody else there. The public seems to have vanished as if he's a leper. He's been punished for calling out his society for its bullying, its coercion, and its inequality. Momus albums often end with a really miserable, self-pitying song. This one, I suppose, goes alongside Gibbous Moon, the H.P. Lovecraft-influenced closer on The Thunderclown. But there's a little postscript on this album in the form of Isaac, the cover version of Prefab Sprouts. Strangest fragment, really, Green Isaac 2. And when I listened to that in the mid-80s, it really did sound otherworldly to me. There was this strange structure in the song, the mixture of Latin and archaic English, these and thous, stella mater, making such a full of thee when you'd love to be someone.
I worship the silence that sings like a bird. I long for the moon as it looks from the earth. It's hard to write sincerely. To avoid, but to have and to hold it, I'd only suggest when you'd love to be someone.
So I recorded this last summer during the Momus and Samoa sessions. I scraped and plucked at the violin and made the cover because I can still only play violin very badly. So I was hoping at my best to sound a bit like the Scratch Orchestra or the Portsmouth Sinfonia, which were two joyously amateur orchestras associated with Brian Eno and Cornelius Cardew in the 1970s. And that final line, when you'd love to be someone, it could be the perfect refrain for an amateur, because being amateur, and I kind of hope I'm still amateur in spirit, it's about working for love, Amoa Masamat, the word love is in there. And it's about aspiring and dreaming. So there's a powerful melancholy feeling in there too, because you feel you can only attain full personhood when you attain fame and professional status, and maybe those will never come. And so you're destined to live your life as a sort of ghost. Perhaps that's the best way to avoid being haunted yourself.